conference listeners would like to join us in giving thanks that our technical people backstage managed to find the new telephone number 2 seconds before the class. We had a little moment of stress back there, and I'm giving thanks that they found it. We're all online together. Our speaker this morning is a gentleman well known to all of us in the Vancouver Center and to many of you overseas as well. Every one of us is the living expression of our mathematical qualities. This is not true. We all recognize that. And when we first read those introductory books, we read the theory, and we see the examples, and we start looking around at life, and it's a bit like you maybe see a cartoon, a line drawing, and it gives you a greater concept of what is meant by the quality of pioneering or diplomacy or whatever. But as we start to interact with our fellow students and with those in our lives who are not in the philosophy, but as we start to work with people we know, those line drawings turn into animated, full-length features. And all of a sudden, we see those mathematical qualities in living color. So, for instance, if we read about the quality of ambition as being a constructive expression of the three, then we get to know a gentleman who sets himself the goal of building his own boat and sailing it across the Pacific. And that quality has a color and an active element that we don't at first see in the original line drawing that is two-dimensional. Or we read about an individual who has expression because of the three quality, for instance, and then we get to know someone who enjoys singing, who enjoys humor, whose bubbly personality is a lift, and who enjoys and appreciates and values the opportunity to express the principle. So here to give us a new insight into his topic for the morning, the hijacking of ambition, please welcome Garrett Hennigan.
Thank you, Stephanie. Good morning, everyone. Thank you, Stephanie, for your very eloquent introduction. You know, time is marching on where, you know, they say this gentleman. I remember one time you used to say, you know, this young man, but now it's changed now. It's this gentleman, and I don't know what the next phase after that is, but we'll have to see. Our listening audience is fortunate that they're not here this morning because they would be very distracted by the aromas that are being prepared downstairs. We're having our big apple harvest. So just so that you in the ether out there are part of us here, we can smell onions, we can smell smoked salmon, there's probably hash brown potatoes, so, and there's probably coffee percolating in the background too. So if you can picture those smells, you'll be right here in the room with us. So the topic this morning is the hijacking of ambition. And when we think of ambition, you know, what is ambition? And what is hijacking? And hijacking, you know, goes back to, I know when that term first came into common use, probably back when there people were hijacking planes to go to Cuba. I seem to remember this when I was back in my early days. That was the first time I probably ever heard that term. And really it means to take something which is supposed to go in one direction and taking it in a direction it doesn't want to go or shouldn't go. And when we think of ambition, what is ambition? And Stephanie mentioned in her introduction that ambition is a quality associated with the three quality, but it's also associated with the five and also the eight. And we see that in a conscious way. You know, somebody wants something and, you know, they have big goals. But really ambition is the power of life trying to express in life. And when you think of the evolutionary pattern of growth, ambition is just that natural power of trying of the seed trying to go to its point of fulfillment, wherever that is. And if you didn't have that power in the seed to grow, you could say that it didn't have any ambition. But we just think of it as just a power of growth. It wants to go to something better, the next step along the way. Now, in human beings, as are, you know, men and women, and as conscious minds, that quality of ambition is a little bit different. But it is still that same power of growth. It's the power of reason trying to go to another level. Now, in plants, animals, I mean, if you think of a little, you know, Douglas fir cone, you'll put into the ground, and it's just starting up as a little seedling, that end result, the ultimate for that particular little cone is a big, high 100, 200-foot Douglas fir tree. And so that power of growth, you could call it the power of ambition, is an instinctive power. It's just, it doesn't say, oh, I want to be a really big tree. It doesn't think in words, because that's relative to humans, to conscious thinking. But it has a power, and it is going step by step towards that end point that it wants to go to. But when in human mind, that quality is there, there's an urge for action, but where that urge goes and what its end result is varies quite a bit by person and by the environment they're in. And in today's world, that power of ambition is shaped by media, by parents, by the education system. And when we, you know, you talk to a young child, it could be 5 years old, 7 years old, and you ask them, well, what do you want to be when you grow up? And, you know, you get these, you know, children go through these phases. Well, you know, I want to be a fireman. I want to be an astronaut. I want to be a doctor. You know, I want to be, maybe you get a little bit older, and I want to be rich. You know, and they all have these material points that they want to go to. And, again, that's shaped by their parents, shaped by all the different influences that are around them. And so, but you seldom will come across a child and say, well, what do you want to be? Well, I want to be a better person. I want to make a contribution to life. And it does come, you know, certain parents who have instilled ideals into their children, that will come out. But in many cases, their ambitions, their goals in life are shaped by the environment around them. But with many of those, you know, activities, you could say, fireman, doctor, whatever, they all have trade-offs. And some of those trade-offs are significant. And when the young child is, you know, picking, oh, I want to be, you know, a doctor, well, what are all the implications of that particular field? And, you know, an example of that is when Carly and I were in on our trip through Hawaii a year and a half ago, I went on this little charter boat, somebody we'd met in the marina, and they were going to go look at they were going to feed some sharks about a half a mile offshore. So I said, sure, this sounds like fun. So we went out, and on this little catamaran this fella Don had, he had about half dozen guests. And there were two young ladies there, young women. They were probably late 20s. And one of the ladies, and I keep forgetting her name was, but it was a 595 name, as I recall, because I gave her a little analysis of her name. And she had just, now, after 10 years of finishing high school, she had, obviously, she wanted to be a doctor because that's what she had trained for, and she had spent a lot of time, obviously, going through, you know, undergraduate, pre-med, the whole bit, you know, and then doing her, what do you call that when you do your practicum? Internship, thank you. And she had done that, so now she had finally finished, and she went back to her 10-year high school reunion. And she still hadn't worked yet, like in a paid job. And somehow we started talking, and you know, I said, "Well, what are you gonna do now?" Well, you know, I have to get a job somewhere, a position, you know, because I got some, you know, I got large student loans. And she said, you know, large student loans. And you know, somehow in my mind, I went, "Oh yeah, you know, probably it's like 25, maybe it's even like 75,000." And somehow I guess asked, "Well, how much are they?" And she said, "Oh, my student loans are $250,000. And I was just taken aback. I mean, you know, we get worried when we get like a $1,000 visa bill or, you know, we have some bill to pay. But $250,000, you know, I was just flabbergasted. And she said, that's actually not that bad. She says, I have some friends, their student loans are $350,000. And they haven't even started work. And she said, The other thing is that the interest rate is a little bit lower than what like a going rate at the bank. I think what she said, something like say 5%. And she went on to say, well, so what happens is as you start working, he says you don't really want to pay that one off because I mean it's kind of like a cheap loan. So you always sort of keep that student loan there and you make some payments on it, but there's no urgency to pay that off. And when you think of, you know, somebody who's a young, you know, relatively young mind, she's, you know, 27, 28, she has all this, you know, this big debt that she may eventually pay off, but she's going, you know, she has to make material decisions, you know, because, you know, if she's going to get a job, it has to be enough money, you know, because she has to make all these, you know, payments, and whether she's doing something she really wants to do, all of a sudden now, her life has a set of priorities or a set of decision-making rules that are there to kind of, in a sense, herd her into a consumer-type direction. You think of her when she gets her first paycheck. Maybe she's making $120,000 a year. Maybe she's making $10,000 a month in her first job. Well, she's been going for 10 years. Of, you know, going to school, she finally gets her first paycheck after they take off the tax. Let's say she's down to $6,000. Think of the person going, well, should I take the, let's say take $5,000 and make a payment on my student loan? The mentality of most people because of our society is, well, maybe I should finally get that car. I've been, you know, working. Maybe I should get a lease. Well, I won't pay cash for the car. I'll get it on a lease because, you know, I'm making a big salary now and so they'll qualify me. So they end up going in a certain route through life, going back, that's all relative to the trade-offs of picking a certain role, certain field of endeavor. And you can pick anyone, you know, whether it's being a lawyer, being a, you know, fireman has certain implications. And so all those different areas that the young minds of today go into, where do they come from? They come from without. And they take them in a certain direction. And you think of the, you know, that particular young lady going through school, how much time and how much energy of that, of their kind of spark was used to accomplish that. How many exams, how many all-nighters did they do? And really that inner potential is taken, it only has really so much power in it. And it's used up the physical energy of striving to go through school to, you know, to become a doctor, and then all of a sudden you got this money, you got this, you know, can you change careers if you don't like it? Pretty hard because you've got all these obligations. So their, in a sense, life force is used and consumed in achieving some of these goals. Now, you know, there's other people that, you know, they, you know, a young boy says, well, I want to be like Wayne Gretzky and play in the NHL and make lots of money. And so they go into it. A lot of, you know, we see the sports figures who do make it, but there are hundreds and thousands who just weren't quite there, just like in music, where people, you know, we see the big music stars who make millions of dollars every year, but there's a lot of them playing in, you know, seedy nightclubs for $50 a night trying to get by because, you know, it's a tough goal. But on the other hand, that the people have ambition and want to go somewhere is better than not having it at all. Because, you know, if somebody has never been, when they're young, stimulated to want something of more and want to accomplish anything, it's very hard. It's easier to change somebody's direction, but it's even harder to actually instill a drive in somebody who's, in essence, a, you know, couch potato who, you know, is satisfied just watching Sunday football and they don't have any ambition in life. It's hard to instill that. So the fact that the children do have ambition and do want to accomplish is a natural urge from that inner potential. But where it goes and how it is developed is the question. And so how do we take this quality of ambition? How do we change it into something where it is going in a direction which is in the, which fits in within the true scope of the bigger picture of life? You know, so we all know that the material part of life, what we do within this physical world, is important, but how it fits in, what role it has, how much time it takes up, what's its point of perspective and relativity to the rest of our life. And that is a challenging problem. But the only way to counter all these different exterior influences that take people and bring them into certain areas of pursuit, which become, in many cases, all-consuming, requires that we have an understanding of this big principle of life. And that principle of what life is and how it functions allows us to put all these different qualities and priorities into some type of order which has balance to it. So what is the principle behind life? And, we can look out, think of the vastness of life, and, we look out on a starry night and you see all the stars out there, and then we read about how in our galaxy there's evidently, at last count, something like 100 billion stars. Not 100 million, but 100 billion within our galaxy. And then they say, oh, well, our galaxy is only one of 100 billion galaxies. And we start thinking of this, and the vastness of it is almost incomprehensible. And then they say, oh, well, this whole universe has been expanding on this current expansion for several billion years. And then we look at our life, which is, 100 years, just not even a fraction of a blip on that whole, process of expression of life. And it seems, we feel like insignificant in this big scope of the picture. But on the other hand, we do recognize and we do know because of our mind, what do we know? And we know we have a mind. We can think. We can relate things. We can conceive the universe. We can think about the universe. And we also know that our thinking has an effect on our life. We know that when we're happy and up, we attract good situations as we go through our day. If we're down, we attract unfortunate experiences. We attract the unhelpful clerk in the store. But if we're up, we find the right thing, we meet the right person, they give you, I'll give you an extra 10% discount. Things go our way based on how our thinking, the quality of our thoughts. So we realize there's a power within our thinking, within mind. And we also realize that the power of mind, through all the people around the world, all the scientists, all the inventors, has brought us all these discoveries about life. So there is the realization, people generally accept that, yes, there is a power to thinking, power to our mind, and that is really the thing that we can count on. And so when we go to the point of, well, what is this power of mind? What is the essence of it? That answer is really the key component of the Cavalarian philosophy. And that is the understanding, as we term it, the five basic truths, which is mathematics, language, name, mind, and conscious development. And so those five terms cover the explanation of what mind is, how it comes into form, how it develops, and what its relationship is to the full picture of life. Now, when we think of the mathematics, it's one of those terms that the world has, we have this preconceived idea of mathematics because it's, you think of math, your mind kind of jumps to, oh, that was in grade school, oh, I did good in math, I did bad in math, didn't like my math teacher. Mathematics is associated with this just mere counting, and that's a common understanding. If you went on the street and did a survey, I'm sure that's what, what's the first thing that comes to your mind when you think of math. But mathematics is more than that and has a bigger concept. And when we think of mathematics, we can think of it as really the process of conscious thought. Because when you, what is conscious thought? Like we compare things. Well, if you're going to compare, this apple to that apple, you go, okay, well, this apple's smaller than that, this other apple. One's bigger. Well, there's a process of analysis. And if you're doing an analysis, your analysis also implies measurement. You're saying, well, you know, this has more size to this. And now you're into, well, how much bigger is it? Is it twice as big? Well, you start going into three times as big or 50% bigger. You're now into mathematics, which is human's mind attempt or process of trying to analyze and structure and compare life. And so that evolves into this process of counting, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. And you think of it, if you were going to some island in the South Pacific, you know, Papua New Guinea is always the one that comes to mind, is still being primitive. And I'm sure every tribe has now been contacted by Western man. But let's say you went there and you were counting this tribe. They had never met you, and they hadn't, you know, given you a blow dart and knocked you out or whatever. But let's say they're friendly natives, and you're sitting around the campfire, and you're there. They don't know English. You obviously don't know whatever language they speak. Where would the basis of your communication be? And you know, this is just my supposition of how it might work, but you know, you go, Garrett, and I go, Carly, because I presume we sailed to this island, so we're on the beach. And so the fella from the tribe, the communication of, you know, who somebody is, he says, Bala. So that's his name, Bala. And he points out different persons, and he goes, his friend next to him, he goes, Balala. And so, okay, they're different. And I go, Balala? No, Balala. So he's Bala, next person's Balala. And then you go onto the ground, and then I put one rock, and then I go two rocks, and I go three, and I go one, two, three. And then you see the recognition, because the process of counting and of comparison is a basic conscious process. And so he would have terms for one rock, two rocks, three rocks. Supposedly in, I think it's Tonga, they go one, two, three, and lots. Like, they'll count. But I'm sure if you went and you said, if you had four and five, they would know, well, that's, you know, they would say, well, that comes after that one, and that's one more than this. Those are basic human characteristics of human thought. And when we were taking our little Spanish language course, in the preamble of the course given by this company called Pimsleur, what they do is, you know, they do like 30 different languages, but they said that there's 500 key concepts, keywords, which make up a language. Now, they say keywords, but they mean key concepts. And so when they're going through the initial tapes, they go through small, more, less, bigger, they count. They go me, you, you know, today, yesterday, tomorrow. All those are things that they would teach in every language as the beginning concepts, because those are how we think. You know, give me more. You know, I need, you know, this object. I need more of that object. And so concepts are key to human thought. And so counting and the recognition of order is just part of what humanity is. And that recognition of order is fundamental. You can't separate who we are and talk to somebody in any language or in any form of communication without this point of comparison. And if you're comparing, you're measuring. If you're measuring, there is some quality of mathematics, because that's what mathematics is this understanding and relationship of comparison, difference between one object and two objects, three objects, and so forth. And when you take mathematics, and then we go to the next basic truth, which is language. And language is different than mathematics, but on the other hand, really, it's just the same thing. And I'm not sure on this, so I stand to be corrected, but I believe in the old Hebrew language, the mathematical symbols were the same as the alphabetical symbols. So, you know, you didn't have two different systems or two different sets of symbols. Like now, if you went to somebody to think of mathematics as mathematics, language, or alphabet as the alphabet. But if you went to somebody and you went and you wrote on the blackboard, B plus B equals D, and then you wrote another line underneath it. I mean, they'll do it here. Can I reach there? Okay. So if I went B plus B equals D, all right, and then I went C plus A equals D. And I'm sure if you took anybody on the street and you went A plus B equals, you know, like you think of these little IQ tests they give on these, you know, in different magazines. If you gave this to somebody, they'd go B plus B equals D, C plus A equals D, all A plus B, and they would go, ah, you mean C. Because people, when they think about it, they go, oh, yeah, the symbols of the alphabet are representative of a position in the alphabet. And this brings to the other point of, you know, mathematics, language, and, you know, when you have some languages that don't have a written Latin script alphabet, well, how do they work? Like Chinese and other ones that are, you know, have clicking sounds, or they have no written symbols that we know of from our first contact with some of these different cultures. But if you think of it, that that fellow we met on Papua New Guinea, whose name was Bala, and his friend was Ba-La-La, if you said, you know, Bala, and you pointed to the fella with that his name was Ba-La-La, you go, no, because he'd heard you only said one la. There's a recognition that there's two la's in his name. Now, he may not call it two, but there is a recognition of measurement. Now, how that, let's say they didn't have a written language or anything like that, how that name converts to mathematics, maybe it's based on, if there's a recognition that, let's go back a step and say, one first fellow's name was La, and the other fellow's name was Lala. Okay? That's ridiculous. But think of it, that the first person, if you called him Lala, he would say, no, La, because there's only one La in his name. He knows. And the other fellow, if you called him La, he said, no, Lala. So they're using mathematics to distinguish between their two names. Maybe, and there's no way of really testing this, but maybe because that is the mathematical measurement system of their language, they don't have they don't have an alphabet to measure that one person's name is Bob or Mary or whatever. They're recognizing that one name has one symbol, one syllable, and another one has two. So perhaps that name of the sounds has one sound, so it has a vibration of one. The other one has two sounds, so it has a vibration of two. Not sure how it would work, but it just shows you that there is mathematics to it. And again, you think of another example of some of these African tribes. You know, the famous movie, The Gods Must Be Crazy. They all had at least clicking sounds. That's the basis of, I'm not sure what language that is. Is it Bushman? Yeah. Yeah. And so they had clicks. So they have long clicks, short clicks, five clicks, three clicks. You know, they're again, a measurement of sounds. And so there's a mathematical conscious recognition, not a position in terms of alphabet, but of the actual symbol, of the actual sounds. Maybe they have syllables and they have an alphabet which consists of sounds that they teach to young people. I was talking with Croft yesterday. That's another possibility. But the point is that there is mathematics because there is measurement. And if there is recognition of one name is different than another, they had to have measured it by some type of process. So when we come to you know, the concept of name, so what is name? And I think I gave this example some time ago that we were in Mexico and we were on this beach and there was a North American family. I think they were from B.C., actually. And he had three children, and they were walking. We were walking on the beach, and it was Kate, Luke, and Maya. That's M-A-I-J-A. And they were standing on the beach, and each one had written out their name in the sand. And they were, because they're all similar amount of letters, they were all finished at the same time. So they were each standing there. They had their name, you know, big Kate there, and they were just like side by side, kind of, you know, standing, admiring, you know, their name. And I kind of jokingly say, are you Kate? And they go, yes, I'm Kate. And it was a vivid illustration that what they had wrote down and no symbols was who they were. And again, if you think that, you know, the alphabetical symbols, if they went and let's say the name of Kate, you know, difficult example, but if the person had written down the numbers 2, 1, what does T work out to be? That's 2, so that's 20th letter. So if they put down a 2 and they put down a 5 and they had that written down, it would be even more obvious that they're saying, oh, I am those mathematics. And that's what people are doing. When we accept the name, we are saying we're equal to that alphabetical symbols, which are really mathematical symbols, and the qualities that make that up. And so it's always a difficult thing when we talk to people to explain that we are our names, because we think of alphabet somehow separately than mathematics. Another example of letters used as mathematical symbols. You know how in computers when they are based on the on-off, so it's all digital. It's 10101111, and so that's how they represent numbers. So in binary, we'll call a binary number. These are representative of ones, these are representative of twos, and these are representative of fours. And so if you see this as a little, 101, that actually is equal to 5 in regular numbers, in base 10. In computers, what they do is they do this thing where they have this term, if you've ever heard it, called hexadecimal, and that's where the first digit goes like this. It goes 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, and then they go A, E, F, A, E, what am I doing here? A, B, sorry, C, D, E, F, and so that translates to a 10, 11, 12, 13, 14, 15, and then when you want to write 16, they write it down as 10. And so these ones is a representative of how many 16s in the number. So that's how they count. And you'll see these numbers, which are like something like A1F2, and that's a number that they use. And so that represents F is 15. So this is equal to 15 times 16. This is equal to 2. This one here is 1 times 16 times 16. And this one is equal to 10 times 16 times 16 times 16. And you add all those up. And so they'll translate that, which is called base 16 hexadecimal, into a base 10 number. The whole point of this is just to show that we use these symbols in the world for different purposes, and we use them as mathematical points. And so, after you get used to counting in this, if you see A1, I know that that means 11. A1 would be 17. There'd be one. If you saw this, A1, that would be equal to, that would be equal to 10 times 16, which would be 160, and plus 1. So A1 is equal to 171. Did I lose anybody?
Yeah.
Hey, it's okay. It's okay. Well, I tried. I really did, right? It was meant to confuse you. It was just to show how they use alphabetical symbols to count. So when we think of the power of name that's attached to a mind because of association by, you know, being called that, recognizing it, writing it out, those children on the beach, they are their name, and they're 6, 7 years old, and that's who they are. That vibration we have studied and recognized through time becomes personal characteristics, how the person thinks, what they desire. And it's almost like a painting. You know, a painting has many colors in it. The name has many qualities, depending on the letters, depending on their last name, nicknames, and so forth. And so that becomes the formula of who that person is, how they think, what they want. And so we have recognized that the conscious evolutionary pattern starts with that first breath. And again, we go and we measure a calendar system where we recognize this day is different from another day. This is 2 more days after that day. We group it into months. We come up with a calendar system that describes the rotation of the Earth around the Sun with all the different variations and exceptions to it. And so that becomes, again, a mathematical relationship that we measure, and then that becomes the intelligence of that or the role and of that particular spark. And so we have the name, which creates the personal characteristics, and then that becomes the reflective power for that inner potential and what happens with it. And so what is the role of that each human life individuality? And so we see it as that we are the conscious part of life, in that our minds are to conceive the bigger picture, to make a contribution so that life is better. And that becomes now a shaping force for this inner power. And when we think of ambition, you know, what should it be? And really, it's that power trying to make a difference into life. And so it may be hijacked by the outside world into various different activities, which consumes that power, that life force of the spark. But we have to see that the principle in this bigger picture shows that we have a role in life from our inner potential, whether we're a water group, air group, fire group, Earth Path 1 to 9, and that we can do something that can change the world. And so this channel of ambition has to be, or this power of ambition has to be directed and given a perspective so that it isn't just pulled into desire, into personal ambition, but into making a more universal ambition where there's something that's going to be contributed to life. And so the understanding of, you know, the mathematics, language, name, mind, and consciousness gives us the ability to see how life is functioning and seeing where the problems are that people have unfortunate experiences because they have a 5 destiny or they have a 9 destiny or they have certain health weakness challenges because of the names they use. Yesterday I was playing squash with one of my friends, and he was saying that this fella who I kind of know, you know, just casually, he's about 25 and his name was Ryan, 134, Hater, and, you know, athletic fella, you know, and he had a brain aneurysm, and he's lost a sight in one eye, you know, and they're thinking that the sight may come back in a year, but they're not sure. So again, you know, one-ish name, I'm not sure what his birth path is, obviously, but all those have a factor. So in understanding those 5 basic truths, gives us really the perspective to realize how important they are to the world and how if we can apply them in our own lives, prove them, make some contribution to alleviate the, I guess you'd say suffering or, I wouldn't say it's just suffering, but just the unfulfillment that people have because of whatever names they're using, that if we can create some understanding, then life can take on a more balanced perspective and can fulfill its ultimate purpose. So when we think of ambition, it's a potential universal energy, and where that energy goes and how it expresses is up to us to refine it and to see the perspective. And if we can we can set ambition in the right direction, then it can make a difference, because then our lives will make a difference, because we're accomplishing worthwhile things that are affecting people and bringing mental and spiritual progress to the world and ultimately making a difference in the world. So let's unhijack ambition and allow it to be that full expression of the power of reason. Good morning.
Thank you so much, Garrett. Garrett always puts so much energy into his presentations. It just has a real lifting power. We've just a few moments left to the end of our class, and we'd like to share with you one of our favorite little sound bites on the topic of optimism.
How important is it to develop the quality of optimism? What part does it play in creating, maintaining a happy mind? What role does it play in mental growth and stability? Can optimism interfere with people seeing the reality of life or not facing the realities of life? Optimism is that first form of expression of the attractive force. If you're not optimistic, how can you attract something better? You say, well, that's not being realistic. You've got to see that the results here. Look, we owe all this much money. We have only got this much money. We're broke. And so someone says, well, all right. Tomorrow's another day. We'll find some money. You say, no, which mind is going to attract something? They'll both attract something, but only the optimistic one will attract something better. Now, maybe they won't find anything better tomorrow, because it doesn't mean to say that just because they're optimistic, it's going to happen. There are many factors involved. But the point I want to make is that optimism is the seed of the future. Optimism is like the nine quality. And when the one comes around, the vision or the seed of the nine is seeded into the one to start things going. And so we should always be optimistic over the future. What does it play in creating a happy mind? Well, my goodness, I think everyone is happier thinking of something better than thinking of something worse. When you think of something worse, it's depressing. When you think of something better, it's encouraging, it's inspiring, and it's hopeful. And so that is how one's mind can help create the future, by having this optimism regarding what one wants to bring about in the future. And stability. Well, it gives a foundation. Optimism is like an anchor. It helps you to stay. You might say, stable, whereas pessimism or we're never going to get out of this hole. You know, it's only going to drag you down, and it's like a big wind dragging the boat, even though it's got its anchor out, it just drags it on its anchor. Well, optimism is a stronger anchor, if you like, to help you withstand the buffeting of challenges because you've got some hope that's based on your optimism. Can optimism interfere with people seeing the reality of life or not facing the realities of life? Well, that's not optimism. That is a misconcept. Optimism is seeing and wishing for the positive potential. It doesn't mean that one has to be illogical or unrealistic. It means that one has to take the circumstances and elevate them to a better level. Now, whatever the realities are, they're going to change, and you can change them, hopefully, with your the creativity of your mind. So everyone should be optimistic. If you don't believe in yourself, how can you look at the future if you don't think, well, I can do that, I can do it better. I'm learning, etc. Just see a better, happier future. How important is it to maintain optimism when all around you the world is losing theirs? Well, the others don't have the principle, and you do. It is very important, very, very important to maintain the optimism throughout all of life, even under the last breath.
Humble.
Sorry, we're having a few little technical glitches this morning. Part of life. We have 7 announcements. Bear with me. First, our next morning philosophy class, 2 weeks from today, is November the 1st. And I'd like to draw your attention to the fact that that is when the clocks change, so you get to sleep for an extra hour. Second, our senior philosophy class next Sunday evening on the 25th of October. I'd like to let you know that there will be a slightly different setup. This is mainly for the students in the Vancouver area who would be coming in. The decision has been made to videotape this new series of classes on our brand new set of books. And in order to give the best possible chance of having an end product that we can share with others in the future, it's been decided that we'll film it with 2 cameras, which means that one of the doorways will probably be cordoned off if you come in, just so you're aware. And we'll be using the back of the hall because we're able to control the background a little better for the purposes of filming. And also because having the cameras on the same level as the speaker creates a more flattering angle than looking up under someone's chin. It's difficult to get a really good close shot that way. So when you come Sunday evening, one of the doors will be cordoned off. There will be some tables set up because we want to create the atmosphere of a studio audience, as we have done for previous classes. But behind that, the chairs will be theater style. So there's an encouragement to those who can possibly cooperate on this to come a few minutes early and fill in those chairs and tables so that we have lots of heads filling the space. And then if you have some good reason where you have to come a bit late, the door that's not cordoned won't cause any problems for you if you just come in, and then there'll be lots of theater-style seating at the back. So the next item would be the Country and Western evening here at 5912 on Saturday the 31st. And I have an announcement regarding the big event, the 64th Annual Craft Fair, Friday, November 13th and Saturday the 14th. Lovely, colorful posters with specific times and lots more detail. And an announcement letting you know that the invitation cards are now available, a postcard size that makes it very easy to tuck in your briefcase or your purse and hand it out to your interested contacts. So, you know, obviously the personal invitation and the personal connection is what brings people to our door. And we all know how proud we are of the quality of goods and services that the craft fair provides annually. So do pick up some posters if you can place them, and do pick up some invitation cards to share with all your contacts. There's also a reminder that the free name report program is continuing until the 23rd of this month. There's some little posters about this as well. And this is a great opportunity if you have a contact with whom you have a nice connection, but you're not quite ready to sit down and do a full analysis yourself. Just let them know about the website and encourage them to check it out, because this is possibly a once-only opportunity for them to get a free name report and introduce them to the concept of the fact that mathematics does shape our lives. There's also a reminder that we can now order our 2010 cycle charts if we would like to get that in. And last but not least, of course, today is our Apple Fest, our Apple Harvest. And the men's club has been beavering away downstairs all morning, as we can tell by the aromas. It's going to be a sumptuous brunch featuring Klondike omelets and all the possible side dishes you could wish for. There will be apple pies for sale. There are boxes of apples. Some of them have been pre-ordered, but I suspect there might be a few if you haven't planned ahead, where you can pick up a box for $20, and these are fresh from the orchard right beside Callaway Bay Resort. So I think we have covered the announcements, and I invite you to close with a song number one, Count Your Blessings. Garrett, won't you join me?
Oh.
join us downstairs for brunch.